Buddy, it's about 12:59 here on Tuesday afternoon, December 5th. I'm going to get started with some housekeeping for our Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance webinar. My name is Devin Setkar. I'm your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. I'd like to welcome everybody on behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council to this webinar. For a fee, today's class does include continuing education units. If you would like to receive two CEUs for this training, please register and pay through ITRC's Wild Apricot portal. That link was on the Clumen training page that brought you here, and I will be putting it in the chat here in a moment. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and cover some housekeeping rules for our training today. This training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this slide, Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance. This guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2019. We cannot cover all the tools, information, and resources available in this document and encourage you to take a look at it if you have not already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you as you work on your environmental sites. I will also be putting the link to this guidance document in the chat in a moment as well. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. So today's training is scheduled for about 2 hours and 15 minutes. It is being recorded and will be offered on demand for those not able to make it or to review at any time. Trainers will be in control of their slides as we move through today's webinar. The slides are also available for download on the CLUIN training page that brought you here today. While in Zoom, you have access to a Q&A window where you can ask questions, make any comments, or report technical issues that you encounter at any time. We will have two Q&A breaks during the training today, and we will try to get to as many of those questions from the Q&A pod as we can verbally. If there are too many to answer, we will ask our trainers to reply via typing a response in the Q&A pod. There is also an online feedback form available for completion at the end of today's training. It is available on the CLUIN training page that brought you here today. We would love to hear how the training went at the end, so please be sure to take a look at it and take a few minutes to fill it out. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. We are a state-led organization composed of members from the state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website and feel free to contact us directly with any questions. We did just launch our 2024 project teams, which are open for new members if you are interested in looking. On our website, you can learn more about those teams and about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy and make sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. With that, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers with us today. All of these trainers have been volunteers of the Optimizing Injection Strategies team over the years and have also volunteered to make this training course possible. I'd like to just say a special thank you to all of them for participating today. If you would like to read more about their background information and bios, they are included on the CLUIN training page that brought you here today. So with that, we are going to get started with the content here today, and I'm going to hand it over to Chris McCandless from the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality.
All right. Thank you very much, Devin. And thank you all for attending this meeting today, this webinar. All of the recent ITRC documents are web-based, so we're no longer constrained to paper sizes anymore. He's already got the poll a question up. Have you ever had a remedy not meet design expectations? So we'll give you a few minutes to look at that. The link to the page, to the document is big there in big bold blue letters at the bottom of this page. All right, what we got? 82%. Good, good. All right, trying to advance. There we go. Oh, too far. Never mind. There we go. Okay. Getting the bugs worked out. All right. So as 82% of you said that you did not have it meet remedy expectations, you said yes to the poll question. That's terrific. So you're in the right spot for the next 2 hours. For the 16% or 18% that didn't, this team would like to know what your secret was if it did meet it. As our first slide implies, this webinar is aimed for your site involving injection of amendments at the correct doses for the in situ remediation of contaminant mass and how to optimize any phase of that process. Although this subject of in situ remediation is far from new, everyone, even the ones who said no to the poll question, have encountered challenges when it comes to in situ remediation. So, the problem we are facing is failing to achieve the expected objectives or performances of in situ injection remedies and encountering unknown variables that impact effectiveness. Our team did a survey of state regulators across the U.S. for remediation proposals that they received. About 40% deemed the first submittal as incomplete. Why? Well, it hinged around an incomplete conceptual site model, or CSM, which in turn led, for example, to inadequate amendment placement or choosing the wrong delivery for the site geology. So, what is optimization? Optimization is the effort at any cleanup phase to identify and implement actions that improve effectiveness and cost efficiency of that phase. Now, this definition is from ITRC's 2016 Geospatial Analysis for Optimization, which first coined the term. For in situ remediation, we are emphasizing the management of risks and uncertainties through sound science and engineering during different stages of in situ remedy planning and implementation. This webinar and the document intend to promote the best practices for the benefit of all, and that includes regulatory agencies, responsible parties, consultants, and the public. So I want you to think of this document and its tables and its fact sheets as an optimization toolbox. On the left is your first introduction to the layout of this guidance. On the right are the tools we are going to use to optimize the remedial process. We want to make it clear that we wrote this document for remediation managers, responsible parties, and regulators. We did not write this document as a remediation 101. You do need to be familiar with the principles of in situ remediation and the preparation of a CSM. We also wrote this for state regulators, like me, to identify potential shortcomings in remediation plans and to ask specific questions of the consultants and responsible parties. Perhaps you've written a good CSM, feel pretty confident about your remedy selection, but you want to make sure there are no data gaps or that your amendments work with the selected delivery method. What are some of those challenges? Are you having higher concentrations after injections compared to baseline? Or is there no indication of a change after an amendment injection? Do you have insufficient amendment distribution and contact at your site? Or, heaven forbid, is your amendment daylighting? Or, worse, are you using the vendor's dosing default values instead of the data from your CSM? So, with these challenges in mind, let's head to Table 1-1 in Appendix B of the guidance. This slide is a snapshot of the commonly encountered issues associated with remedial design characterization. This is one of three sections in this table, the other two being commonly encountered issues with amendment dose and delivery, and commonly encountered issues with field implementation. As you identify your lithology and contaminant, so the left two columns, you can read the common challenges, lessons learned, and get answers via the fourth column, which contains links to the contact content within the text, links to particular delivery or amendment fact sheet, and links to other documents, including applicable ITRC guidances documents as shown here. I want you to think of this table as your custom table of contents, tailored to your particular site condition. Basic. Here are today's learning objectives. We have just been identifying the challenges. Now the key phrase or watchword for today is in that second bullet, is iterative optimization. Keep that in mind as I keep going through this introduction. Let me show you better how the rest of this webinar will be laid out. So this is the presentation roadmap, and I've introduced the optimization process. Rich is going to cover the remedial design characterization. Suzanne will cover amendment, dose, and delivery for the green circle there. And Elizabeth will cover the implementation, monitoring, and interpretation. And then I'll circle back for stakeholders and regulatory considerations. So this is just giving you a brief glimpse at the key graphic that we designed for this webinar and for the document. So the flowchart on the left is likely familiar to most of you because it is the CERCLA process of remediating sites and taking them to closure, which is similar to the RCRA process for petroleum impacted sites. As we developed this guidance document, we realized that the linear approach to the left gave us no flexibility, and so our key graphic was born. By now, you've gotten a good hint of our three main elements of our document. We've got the remedial design characterization in the top red hexagon, which is section two. We've got the amendment, dose, and delivery in the design section wheel, the design wheel in section three, and then section four is the implementation, monitoring, and interpretation hexagon. Can you see the difference simply in the arrows connecting both diagrams, left and right? We discovered that optimization was the outcome of better characterizing our subsurface conditions, improving the CSM, performing bench tests and pilot studies, making mistakes, and then going back to an earlier step, i.e., the double-headed arrows. We realized that the most flexible approach had to be iterative. So we're not replacing the RCRA chart to the left. We are augmenting it by placing our key graphic in the between the steps of remedial action and remedial design. And as this slide shows, the iterative approach is not new. This slide shows you where our three optimization steps fit into the flow chart for the remediation of DNAP. In ITRC's 2011 Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy document. Here, I'll say it again. The true nature of in-situ remediation is iterative. As Suzanne and Elizabeth will demonstrate during the bench and pilot test phases of design, which is the green design wheel in section three, and in the full-scale application of the blue hexagon, section four, the process of implementing, monitoring, and optimization of the in-situ remedy takes place. Do you see the opportunities for optimization, i.e. the return arrows or feedback loops that take you back to the miniature design wheels if, let's say, an amendment or delivery method didn't work? The iterative approach lets the CSM become more adaptable to new technologies and new contaminants, as you'll see coming up. All right, so now we're going to get into our first hexagon, which is remedial design characterization with Rich DeRozier of GZA Geoenvironmental. Take it away, Rich.
Thank you, Chris. Great job as always. And I think you stressed the optimization and the iterization that is necessary to be successful with in-situ treatments. So as we move forward with the process, I'll be talking about the characterization and the data that's really necessary to have a successful treatment system. And this data is probably maybe a little bit more than what is typically used on a site, and the reasons why, as Chris pointed out in the first poll, that several people have had to go back in and redo things because of missing information. So we developed this key word, the RDC, Remedial Design Characterization. So what is that? It's really a collection of additional data above and beyond the general site characterization that's necessary to develop a sufficiently detailed conceptual site model. In this new site model, we think of a site model as the entire site, and that is really true from the standpoint of defining the nature and extent of the contamination. But here we're really also looking at how do we define the conceptual site model in the area of where we're going to design the remediation. And so this really enables the design basis to be successful when we're implementing an in situ remedy. Could you advance the slide? I don't think I have control. Thank you. So again, the RDC is the additional data in the area of remediation where we may have lack of detail or insufficient data to develop the conceptual site model to strategically target where we're going to add amendment. And so this is really understanding the subsurface conditions, looking at the lithology, looking at the geochemistry, looking at the hydrogeology. How and where are we going to inject? And this is the data that we're looking for. Next slide, please.
Rich, try just clicking one more time.
Nope.
Nope. Okay. No worries.
So on the impact of the data, so this is an example that we have up. And in this example, what you can see is that we have some data. And the data here is showing that we have a lithology, the gray being low permeable soils, the light green, more moderately permeable, and the darker green being very highly permeable soils. So we have seven borings across a 140-foot segment. We have 3,500-foot linear alignment, and we have soils that have been logged every 5 feet. Next slide, please. As we look at the impact of high-resolution site characterization, and I can't stress enough that really high-resolution site characterization is really critical in understanding the lithology and the placement of where we want to do things, because here you start seeing more definition. So what's happened here, there are more borings. So we have 40 borings over the same 3,500-foot alignment. We have the soil still logged every 5 feet, and the soil logging is continuously below the first saturated zone. And you start in seeing the increase in complexity of the site itself. And so from that standpoint, we see that these datas tend to produce more information. Next slide, please. Now, here we've collected 60 borings over the same interval, and we're starting really kind of see that the lithology here is really kind of a lot different than what we first originally saw, that the borings are now continuously logged, and we start seeing this cross section evolve into much more complex situations. We see the blue lines representing various perched or different groundwater levels within the subsurface based upon the monitoring well network. We see the geology has a lot less permeable zones, more lower permeable zones than what we initially looked at. So here we can definitely see that the more information we have helps develop how we're going to develop our concept to inject material. Next slide, please. So what do we need to know about the geology, the hydrogeology, in order to develop this RDC. So we have properties that define the flow regimes, the silts, the clays, the coarse grain nature of the sediments. We have the hydrogeology. What is the hydraulic conductivity, the transport mechanisms for the contaminant to migrate through? Those geochemical parameters, such as electron acceptors, what are the competitors, what are the mobile metals that might be present that we have to watch for when we do the injections? And what's the microbiology? What is the degradation potential that might occur? So next slide, please. So all of that data has to be brought in and to this RDC concept. But again, why do it? And again, I think this slide really is one of the critical takeaways in the characterization section of the document. So this figure 2-1 shows two lines. So we have the first line, which is the red line. And that's the one where we traditionally go with the ineffective remedy. You need to rework the project. You've got to go back out and get additional data. So you can see that here, your time frame is on the bottom and increasing to the right, and your costs are on the left and increasing to the top of the page. So we all agree that the preliminary investigations, the phase ones, the phase twos, the phase threes, that's in the first box to the left. The second box is really showing the without the RDC, and you're spending more money with the RDC. And then what is the effect of having that information? Well, you can see the blue line starts shrinking in terms of time-wise. It's not as long as the red line, and the costs are coming down. So the effect of this is really showing that you have not only cost savings, but time reduction in terms of reaching the remedy. Next slide, please. So here's a case study. The setting is in California Central Valley. It's a 20-acre site. It's impacted with volatile organics to soil and groundwater. The geology is floodplain deposits, and the target treatment zone is a sand lens several feet thick, approximately 15 feet below grade. So we had a tight redevelopment time frame, so everybody wanted to get it done fast. And the solution was enhanced in-situ bioremediations implemented using sodium lactate. Next slide. So the good news is the geology was well characterized. The injections were properly performed within the sand intervals. However, what was missing from the investigation was the lack of hydraulic conductivity, not fully evaluated. An injection test was not performed to look at what the zone of influence might be on the amendment. The geochemical parameters were not used to assess the viability of the treatment option. There were no treatability testing. The choice of the substrate was based upon similar sites. And how many times do we go in and say, wow, it's pretty much like it was on the other site I did. I'm going to use the same thing. That's not always the case. Microbial studies were not performed, and the upgradient source was not fully addressed or removed. So on the next slide, we can see that what is the outcome? So there was no reduction in the groundwater contamination, even though we hit the target treatment zone, and the site development was delayed. So if you saw that figure 2-1, where both time and money could be reduced with having RDC. So what this site needed was better definition of the source area, more plume delineation, higher level of estimating hydraulic conductivity and the radius of influence, microbial testing, treatability studies of the substrate, and removing the upgradient source. So we have a poll here. If you could bring that up, please, Devin. Have you ever had to perform an in-situ rework because of poor initial site characterization? So we'll take a minute here, and we'll go over this particular one in a minute. But more importantly is that by using similar type of products or amendments on a site that may be different, it's really important to understand all these parameters that are related to the characterization. So what do we have on the poll, Devin? We see that 73% have had to do rework because of poor initial site characterization. And I think that's what we found as a group at ITRC. So we can close out of that and go to the next slide. And so here's that case study. So we have a couple of different things. In the first column, we see the cost at $960,000 versus the hypothetical using RDC at $580,000. Next slide. So we can see the upfront cost for RDC cost $160,000 more than the first without doing it. Next click, please. We can see that the rework costs the same thing because, you know, that's what we had to do on reworking the site using the RDC. Next slide. And you can see that the rework saved, you know, we had to go back in, but using the RDC up front, we would have saved $380,000 and we would have cut 3 years off the remedy. So you can see the effectiveness of coming in up front and not having to redo things, you know, time and time again. It's basically, you can see that in the second column, there's a significant savings as identified in figure 2-1. Next slide. So this is a table that is in the document. It's table 2-2, and we don't expect you to read it on this. We're going to get into that in more detail. Next slide, please. But it's important to note, what are we trying to point out? We're looking at physical properties, flow properties, and aqueous geochemical properties. Next slide. And then we're looking at the microbiology and the degradation potential pathways. So on the next slide, you can see a little bit more detail in terms of what we have. The headers are really looking at the remedies, alternative screening, remedial design, or performance monitoring, whether it's an in-situ approach that's abiotic or adiabatic. And then on the legend, whether it's more applicable, less applicable, and the importance of the data, you can see the color code, low, medium, and high. Next slide. So here's a little bit closer of those tables that you could not read on the previous slide to understand what we're trying to point out. So here we have a series of parameters, the in-situ approach and the remedy. But each one of these parameters, if you do the click again, please, you can see that we have, you know, mineralogy here. So that's basically, you can hover over this, and if you click, please, what you'll see is there's a pop-up box that comes in with a definition. On the next click, please. You can also see that anytime you go through, so here's stratigraphy. It gives you a definition of, you know, what it is, gravels, sands, interfingering. So each one of these parameters provide you a pop-up box that's in the reference at the back of the document. And here's another example of heterogeneity. Next slide, please. And isotropy as well. And then we can go into the aqueous geochemical. So here, again, we're in the same thing, except now we've gone into the geochemistry. And so let's take a look at sulfate. Next slide, please. So here we have a definition of sulfate. And, you know, sometimes it's naturally present. Sometimes we're adding the sulfate or trying to develop sulfate in the formation. So again, it provides you some information for pre-remediation and things you might want to look for as part of the remediation. Next slide, please. So here you can see in terms of the terminal electron acceptors as you go down, sulfate is down at the bottom of this. And we have a poll here that asks the question, has sulfate been beneficial or an inhibitor to your in-situ implementation? So I'll give you a second to look at that. And again, sulfate is one of those things that, let's see what everybody has to offer. So Devin, let's see where we're at on that poll. And I think it's mixed. I think a lot of people will find it as being a benefit in terms of their in-situ performance. And sometimes, yes, it does become an inhibitor. But more importantly, these are the parameters that we need to be able to identify ahead of time to determine whether or not it's present, to determine whether or not it will be a benefit to the project or an inhibitor to the project so that you can go ahead and use that in your final amendment dosing. If you can close this and go to the next slide, please. Again, here we have the aqueous geochemical, another poll, please. And this poll is also going to ask in terms of chloride, whether or not, you know, chloride concentrations are effective as a line of evidence for reductive dechlorination. So we'll have to see what everybody thinks on this one. I always love this. You only get a single choice. You can pick yes or no, but you can't pick both. Could we have those results, Devin? So again, I think we can see that, you know, a lot of people answered, you know, 54% saying yes. But again, chloride could be one of those things that you could use in terms of dechlorination as to what's present. But again, looking at it from the aqueous geochemistry standpoint. Next slide. So now we're heading into the microbiology and degradation potential. So again, you can see here, again, you just hover over it. These things are going to pop right up. And, you know, here we have dissolved hydrocarbons. So we're looking at these things to evaluate reductive dechlorination, you know, methanes and other parameters that we can evaluate. So we've given you low, medium, and high on these. Next slide. So we've come to our first break. And in the break itself, if you have questions, we'll be putting those into review and we'll probably provide some answers to that. And then the next presenter will talk about the design amendments and dosing and delivery. Devin, back to you.
Thanks so much, Rich. All right, he summed that up perfectly. This time we're going to have our first Q&A, and then we will move on to the next sections and then have another Q&A at the end. I just would like to send a quick reminder to everybody. I did put the link in the chat here, but there are continuing education units available for today's training course. We will be closing registration for those around 2 o'clock. So if you would like to purchase any CEUs for this, then please do so before then. So with that, I'm going to look to our Q&A pod here to read out some questions for our trainers to answer. Our first question, what is the best way to estimate cost saving of RDC for a site to convince a client, for example?
You know, that's a great question, convincing the client. So I think we're looking at it a couple of different ways. I think the first thing we have to advise our clients is that under the typical phase 1, 2, and 3, we're looking to define the nature and extent of the contaminant and where the plume is both vertically and horizontally. The more important thing is that the client needs to understand that the additional high resolution site characterization is going to be beneficial from a couple of different points. Is A, you can see from the case studies that we can put the amendment in the proper locations. And B, that by understanding what all the benefits and the inhibitors are, that we understand the dosing correctly so that when we inject the material, we're only doing it once or maybe having to come back again, but we're not having to redo the conceptual site model and then the amendments on top of that. So we're looking for positive results.
All right. Thank you, Rich. Next question. What kind of microbial analysis do you recommend during the design stage?
I guess I'm going to also look to the group and see if anybody else has any. But again, it's sort of what is the goal of the remediation? So if we're looking for a reductive dechlorination and we're injecting an oxidant, then maybe the microbial analysis is not so much as to what the oxygen demand might be. But maybe Elizabeth or Suzanne, maybe you have something in terms of microbial analysis in terms of the design stage in your talk.
Yeah, I mean, I touch a little bit on that in the bench test portion, but, you know, I think it will depend on what remedy you're looking at. I mean, if you're looking at a bioremediation remedy, then what bacteria are essential to that? And then you can be testing for the presence or absence of those bacteria. You can also look to see if there's material or conditions that are inhibitory to those bacteria. And that's something you can test in the lab. And then it's not always just presence absence, but if the bacteria may be present but at such low concentrations that maybe you want to bioaugment, so add more of those beneficial bacteria so that you can speed up the remedy, because even though you have to buy that bacteria, if you're cutting down the length of your remedy, you're cutting down the number of times you have to do performance monitoring, all those other things. It can be a benefit to the cost. So it really will depend on what your remedy is.
Yeah, and I think one other thing on that is I've had a site that, we were doing, reductive for hexavalent chromium, and the aquifer was so strongly oxidized that the bacteria present in the aquifer was almost zero because it was basically oxidized away. We didn't have anything there, so we needed to understand that as we were moving forward, that we could reduce things with either the ORP or the pH. And in our case, we had to drive the ORP down. So it was important to know that we weren't going to be relying on the in situ bacteria to do anything for us. We had to do it all through the amendment process itself.
And I might want to add, because I sometimes forget to mention this when I do my section of the presentation. This is Elizabeth Rhine. For the case study that I go over, we actually did none of the bacterial analyses for that site because we did a pilot study in advance and we knew that we could control the ORP, the DO, and we knew we got complete reductive dechlorination. There was no stalling at DCE or anything, so we had all of the data we needed to indicate that it was occurring through that biological process, and therefore didn't feel the need to confirm it. And what I've seen at other sites is that when you do put your biotraps out, it'll work in some wells and not in others, and you get a little bit of confusing data. But we have actually used that data to transfer water around to try to seed the site with water from other parts of the site where we knew we had the proper bacteria, and just to kind of speed up the process of getting bacteria where we needed them instead of just waiting for them to gravitate towards the amendments in an effort to speed it up. So you don't always have to do it if you've got other lines of evidence that it is occurring. It's not always necessary, but in I think these days we are more typically to go ahead and run the analysis. Also to know that whether or not we have competition from other bacteria that may be also anaerobic, and you don't want to get a whole bunch of sulfate reducing bacteria that compete with your Dahalicoides and all the amendments you're going, all you're doing is creating a situation where the wrong bacteria are out competing the ones you're trying to get to proliferate. Does that make sense?
And not only does it make sense, but I think it also points out the fact of why you want to do the geochemistry and understand that before designing. And again, going back to the first question, how do we convince our client? And again, all of these issues are really important to the client to be successful when you're doing the injection. So again, finding out all these information ahead of time before implementing is really the whole basis for the RDC.
Wonderful. Thank you, trainers. All right, we have another question here, and then we will move on to our next sections. Do you know of a resource that helps narrow down the types of bench or pilot tests that would be useful? Some kind of database where you could enter known site characteristics and contaminants, and it would point towards options.
Well, in a way, this document does that. You mean, I think there are documents out there which help you evaluate what remedies might be effective. And really, the bench tests and the pilot tests are just steps to confirm that the remedies you're considering are going to work for your site-specific conditions, or and give you parameters that will help you with design. What kind of oxidant demands are you going to have, and how do you build that into your design? So I think the bench tests and the pilot tests are just steps in the process to help confirm and collect additional data, and then the this document and others point to sort of what remedies are going to be ones that you would consider for site-specific conditions, as well as what's your hydrogeology, your geology, as well as what your contaminants are.
All right, thank you so much, Suzanne. So with that, we will move on to our next section, which is going to be amendment delivery, dose and design, and Suzanne is going to lead us through that section.
Okay.
All right, Suzanne, take it away.
All right. So, as already shown on in Chris's section at the introduction, section three of the document focuses on design, and it has this design wheel, which because the design really involves a consideration of your amendment, your delivery method, and your dose. You need to be thinking about those things simultaneously throughout your design. And it also then carries over into your implementation and your monitoring process. So any step in the sequence can be repeated or modified as new information becomes available. So if you haven't got the message yet, what we're really hammering home here is the iterative nature of this design. And that design wheel applies at different stages in your remedy. And we have this what we call the optimization staircase, where you're basically taking the your once you've selected your amendment and your delivery strategy, you're gonna maybe do a series of tests, things like bench tests or pilot tests, and all of those can apply the same dose, delivery, and amendment feedback. So in a bench test, you're going to be testing a certain amendment. You're going to be figuring out what dose makes sense. And to a certain extent, you're also what delivery mechanism are you going to be using? You're going to implement it, you're going to monitor it, and then you've got an optimization step there. You may go back up, change your dose, maybe you're going to try a different amendment, or maybe you got enough information from your bench test that indicates it's, you've got a success and you're maybe ready to move to your pilot test if you're going to do a pilot test. So I think the big thing here is that each one of these steps, anytime you're collecting information, you should be considering that information in the larger scheme of things and feeding that in to refine your subsequent test or your subsequent step in your design. So one of the first things you have to do with your design is determine your target treatment zone. And that also can be a bit of an iterative process. You're going to be considering things like collateral effects, performance, costs. And as you collect all this information and set your target treatment zone, you may need to revise your design as your target treatment zone. Sorry, you might need to revise your target treatment zone as your design is developed. Some of the key things you need to consider for defining your target treatment zone are things like your cleanup objectives. Those objectives may be to reduce source mass. Maybe you're trying to protect a particular receptor. Maybe you're trying to meet an interim remedial goal, achieve site closure, or there may be other site-specific objectives that you need to consider. If you're using more than one remedy for a site, and then the target treatment zone for each of those remedies has to consider how they're going to interact with each other. For instance, if you had in situ chemical oxidation plan for your source area, but you were thinking of using an in situ chemical reduction for your plume, you need to understand how those two source or treatment areas are going to interact with each other because those are not necessarily compatible. Another thing to consider are uncontrolled amendment discharges. So, for example, if you have a site where you know you've got groundwater discharging to surface water, then your target treatment zone should consider the potential for the transport of the remedial amendments to that discharge area. And maybe you need to figure out where you're going to do that, what methods you might use. Those are the kinds of things that you want to consider. And then, of course, geology, hydrogeology, and the geochemical characteristics of your site are pretty key to also setting that target treatment zone. There's a number of design support elements that can help with your design, and they're basically an extension of your conceptual site model and your remedial design characterization data. So, again, we've sort of alluded to this, but the number one source of failure for a lot of amendment injections is a lack of adequately detailed characterization of your target treatment zone and or a reliance on an overly simplified conceptual site model. So some of the design elements that can be used to help support your design are things like modeling and analytical tools, laboratory bench testing, and field pilot tests. And I'm going to touch on those in this section. So to help us walk through some of these examples, we've got a case study. We've got a site here where there's a historical solvent release. We've done at this site, the characterization's already been done. We know where the mass is. There's mass, a lot of mass in that sand and silt, and some of it has gone into the underlying clay. We have a pretty good idea of the geology, the hydrogeology, and now we're ready to do some of the remedial design and planning. And with the fact that this is a chlorinated solvent release site, that two of the technologies that we're going to be considering here are in situ chemical oxidation and bioremediation. So one of the first tools that we can use are design support elements we can use are modeling and analytical tools. Those can be parameter estimation tools, groundwater flow and transport models, or geochemical reaction or geochemical models. They can range from simple spreadsheet calculations to complex 3D models. And some of that software is publicly available and others are commercially available and require a license. And there is a table, I think it's table 3.1, in the design document, which lists all the publicly available software and how they might be applied. Another one of those design support elements that you can use are laboratory treatability bench scale testing. Bench tests help to determine the type and dosing of amendments. Sorry. They provide data to support remedial technologies or a series of specific treatments. And ideally, if you're doing a bench test, you're using site-specific material, so soils or groundwaters from your site, to confirm that the treatment is effective for your site-specific chemistry. These are really great tools in situations where your chemistry is complex or where you may be considering multiple treatment steps and you can understand how those might interact with each other. They're effective and timely in evaluating the degradation or transformation of contaminants or suites of contaminants. Sorry. Give me one second. I'm just going to take a drink of water. Bench tests are often conducted under ideal mixing conditions, though. That can increase or decrease the results of your amendment requirement estimates relative to field conditions. Field heterogeneity and its influence on amendment transport, reaction kinetics, and other characteristics it's difficult to accurately represent that in the laboratory. For instance, if you look at that photo on the bottom, we've got a batch test there where we've got soil and groundwater from a site. It's sitting on a mixing tray at room temperature. We're shaking it. So we've got, almost perfect contact between our amendment and our materials. So generally, bench tests are not accurate models for field conditions due to issues of scale. That top photo, though, is with a column study. Then you're getting a little bit further along to maybe mimicking some of the complexity that you would see at a field as you're getting water flowing through that column and it's encountering new material as it travels. But still, you know, it's not accurately representing what you're going to see at a field scale. However, the great initial screening level evaluations of potential outcomes and effects of the treatment, and they can be utilized to inform and initially optimize your field remedial design and monitoring strategies. One thing bench tests are really good to do are help evaluate some of the secondary effects that might occur. And that is something that's really important to consider when you're doing your design. Those secondary effects can occur over a wide range of time. You may get a transient shift lasting a couple hours or days, things like maybe water elevation increases or changes when you're doing injections, or long-term changes that could last years, like redox changes or pH changes. So you need to consider those effects when you're designing your remedy. Some of them are what you're aiming for, their desired effects. Some of them may not be. And if they're not, then you need to figure out how to potentially mitigate those effects. And bench tests and pilot tests can be, you know, a really good tool to help evaluate that. There's an example there. If you add sodium persulfate to a site, sometimes if there that may affect the natural or anthropogenic chromium present that could be in the soil or an aquifer matrix, which could be oxidized to hexavalent chrome. So if that is something that might be occurring at your site, it's very important to know that ahead of time. So I'm going to pull up a poll here. So if you, the question here is if you've used bench tests in your design for an in-situ remedy. And maybe we can see what the answers are. Looks like 50-50. So some people have used it and others haven't. And then I have a second poll, sort of follow on to that one. If you have used bench tests in your design, did the results of that bench test change your approach? All right, see what the answers are. So some heavy weighted more towards yes than no. So just again, some information to consider as we move through your design. Sometimes those can be very useful tools. All right, so if we go back to our case study here, we are going to do some bench tests for this site. So when we were doing our site characterization, we took site soil and groundwater from the site, and we were doing an in-situ chemical oxidation bench test and a bioremediation bench test. And the bio test, we were using emulsified vegetable oil as the donor. So the bench test indicates that the in-situ chemical oxidation was faster than the bio, but it does produce more secondary effects, some of which are not desirable. And it also had a higher oxidant demand than was ideal. So when we look in comparison to the bio, which has fewer of those secondary effects, it works out to being cheaper longer term when we look at the bio. And so that is what we have chosen as the option for this site. So we've got a successful pilot test or bench test. Now we're ready to maybe go to a pilot test. And the objectives of your pilot tests are to evaluate the impacts of heterogeneities on, so you know, what is present at your site, the heterogeneities in both contaminant and geology, hydrogeology, and what effect does that have on your remedial technology. It allows you to evaluate the remedy timeframe under real-world conditions. So you're seeing combined effects of dilution, advection flow, diffusion, adverse chemical reactions that might be happening. It allows you to determine your amendment distribution. What kind of radius of influence are you getting? What kind of injection rates can you sustain? What pressures and volumes are you able to inject? And then it also allows you, like we talked about for the bench test, to evaluate those secondary effects. Are you mobilizing any metals? Are you getting any adverse acid production? And another thing that does is allows, you know, an ability to identify where would be good performance monitoring points for your full-scale remedy. So field pilot tests are smaller scale preliminary field events. They're performed at the site under site-specific in-situ conditions. And they're really going to be used to test the assumptions incorporated into your design at the full-scale remedy. And a pilot test can be, some pilot tests can be bigger than a full scale remedy at another site. You know, they can be quite involved. They can be as simple as going out to a site with a direct push injection equipment and injecting potable water and evaluating, you know, what kind of injection rates can you get at X pressure. And, you know, if you want to, does the volume of water injected over time change? You know, there's different, they don't need to be big and complex. You're basically getting an opportunity to collect data to feed into your conceptual site model and to feed into your design. One of the key things, once you're out in the field, that can, you know, that is going to affect your delivery of your amendment is the geological heterogeneity. And what we're showing in this diagram here, are the earth tones are representing the various geologic layers. So the darker browns are lower permeability zones. The warmer colors are areas of contamination. So the highest concentrations are identified in this drawing by orange. And then the purple is the amendment that we're injecting. So in the less heterogeneity, I can't say that word, the lower, you know, case of the case on the left, you're getting a bit more uniform delivery. And then the more heterogeneous case, so the one on the right, you're getting more variability and more effect of the lateral influence versus depth. So that's a pretty key part of understanding where your amendment is going to go. And again, the better characterized your site is, the better understanding you're going to have of that distribution. Another key part of your delivery strategy is distribution. And the amendment distribution through porous aquifer media is not only controlled by the permeability of the formation and the heterogeneity of that formation, but also by the nature of the amendment itself. So you can have soluble amendments like lactate or semi-soluble like emulsified vegetable oil that we're talking about for our case study, or insoluble donors like carbon or zero-valent iron. Those high permeability zones generally are going to accept more of your fluids and allow the broadest radial delivery. And this is just a note to consider. So in this, again, in our case study where we've got the, you know, an underlying clay layer, which does have some impacts and has, you know, you're going to maybe getting back diffusion of contaminant mass storage in that low permeability can be a significant source of plume longevity. And so we need to consider that too in your design. Another part of your delivery strategy to consider is the pressure. So the pressure at which your fluid is being injected or applied into that formation. High pressure emplacement technologies, for instance, using hydraulic or pneumatic injection methods, are required to deform the aquifer matrix and propagate seams or fractures within an aquifer matrix. And you have to use that type of aggressive or high pressure emplacement technology if you're using something like maybe a microscale zero valent iron or an activated carbon where the actual amendment solid particle can be larger than the pore throat. So the only way to get it in there is to deform the matrix to distribute it. Soluble amendments like our organic carbon substrates and chemical oxidants can be delivered under high pressure, but they can also be delivered under lower pressure, including just gravity flow. Because they're able to move about more easily. So we have table 3.4 in the document, and this is a table which looks at the injection and placement delivery methods. So across the top of the table is the six delivery methods as column headers, and each one of those has a link to a fact sheet. On the far left of the table is a list of the subsurface characteristics of your site that influence the applicability of the injection or emplacement methods. And then the cells in the tables themselves are either flagged as something that could be widely used, maybe used in a site-specific condition, or may not be applicable at all. So it allows you to use this table by selecting the hydrogeologic or physical characteristics that best fit the site or your site target treatment zone. And then you can evaluate, you know, using those rows, what technologies might be feasible. And what, you know, once you've got maybe one or two that you would consider, you can go to the fact sheets for each one of those, and it's going to give you the types of equipment that would be used, the types of delivery, some of the advantages of the delivery techniques, some of the limitations of the delivery techniques, health and safety considerations. That sort of information is included in those fact sheets. So we go back out to our field. We had successful bench test results. So, and we're proceeding with emulsified vegetable oil as our bioremediation amendment at this site. And our pilot test, we go out and doing direct injection of EVO. And in the sand layer, what we're seeing is that we're getting a good radius of influence at relatively low injection pressures, and we're seeing a good distribution of our amendment in our target treatment zone. The clay layer, on the other hand, we're seeing higher injection pressures than maybe we want. There's evidence of short-circuiting actually up in that sand layer as opposed to distribution through our clay layer. So getting poor distribution, uneven, and very small radius of influence. So we're getting success in that sand and silt layer, and ready to proceed to full scale for that layer. But we're not sure what's happening with what the best approach will be for the clay layer. So I'm going to pull up a poll again. And the first question of that, or first portion of that poll, is, have you used a pilot test in helping you design your in-situ remedy? And we'll maybe see what the answers are. A lot of people have used pilot tests, which is great. They're a very handy tool. And then same thing, I guess, similar to our bench test. If you have used a pilot test remedy, has it changed your design? And have you learned enough from it to either completely change or some way change your design? All right. Let's see what the results of that one look like. Good. So people are taking the results of that design generally and amending their design as appropriate. And maybe those who didn't need to, because they got the answers that they needed in the first place. So that's also good. So we go out to the site, and we are going to implement our EVO distribution in our sand layer. And just as another plug for your conceptual site model and your remedial design characterization, you're out there, you're doing your full scale remedy, you're installing wells for monitoring, log those wells. Does that data agree with your conceptual site model? Is at any chance and every chance during your injection, are some layers seeming to take more fluid than others? Does that agree with your conceptual site model? We can continue to refine that conceptual site model at every step of the process, during your design, during your implementation, and during your monitoring. So just collect data and consider that data at all times. Your conceptual site model should be a living document. But we're stuck here in our clay layer, and one of the things that we consider doing for this clay layer is maybe switching to EK Bio, which is electrokinetic bioremediation. We don't have any information, site-specific information on that. We haven't done any testing, so consider going back to a bench test. But electrokinetic remediation, or specifically for bioremediation in this case, uses low-level direct current power to distribute amendments in low permeability matrix. So you're not using a hydraulic gradient. You're not trying to push things through there. You're using the low-level direct current power to do the distribution. And it can distribute electron donors like lactate or acceptors like oxygen and nitrate. And it actually can also help distribute the microorganisms themselves. So when we're out here doing our full scale for the sand layer, we drilled a bit deeper and got some additional clay materials and groundwater from that lower level. And we go back to our bench test. You can see in this photo, we've got a treatment cell here with our clay in there, and we've got an anode and a cathode, and we're able to apply your direct current across that. Now, emulsified zero vanillin iron is not something you would use if you're trying to use EK to distribute it. So we testing instead lactate here, and evaluating the transportation rate that we can get with the direct current. This is a successful bench test. It shows that we were able to do that in a time frame that seemed to work, and we were able to see some degradation occurring in this cell during treatment. So then we head back out to our site and do a very small pilot test, just a dipole test, where we're going to do maybe one or two injection or anode and cathode wells. We can again test that this is scaling up well and collecting the information that we need to do our design of our full scale remedy. And then we go back out to our pilot test our field scale rather, sorry. And here, our full scale is ongoing in the sand and silt. So it's just none of the instrumentation shown. And what we've set up is a series of anode and cathode wells that allow us to distribute our lactate throughout our treatment interval. And one of the nice things with the EK approach is that you can switch which wells are anodes and cathodes to really maximize, getting a nice even distribution of your amendment throughout your target treatment zone. And there is a fact sheet on EK Bio in the document in our document as Appendix B3. So throughout all of this, to date in our case study, we've been looking at the distribution in cross-section, but another component of your delivery or distribution is also the refinement of the number and the spacing of those injection points, injection transects or recirculation wells, so that you can try to minimize the cost or time using one of the delivery strategies that's going to work best for your site. So grid pattern is that first one that's shown there. You basically have delivery locations that are spaced uniformly throughout your treatment zone. It's broadly applicable. There's very few site-specific constraints that would challenge this method. One thing to think about is that, you might want to start injections on the outside and work inward in your distribution to try to limit any smearing or spreading of your plume while you're doing your injections. The second one there is the injection and drift method, and that's going to leverage the distribution of your amendment with natural groundwater flow. So it's going to be applicable in situations where your amendment is soluble in water, where your groundwater velocities are relatively high, and or the amendment is relatively persistent in the subsurface so that you can actually get that distribution between your rows of points. The third one in there, recirculation, you're simultaneously injecting your amendment in one end and extracting from the other end. This can increase the lateral extent of the amendment influence, and it also helps to potentially reduce the risk of daylighting of the amendment. So in that earlier example where I gave where you might have a concern of groundwater discharging to surface water, you could consider using this method between, say, your surface water body and the downgrading edge of your target treatment zone. You put your extraction wells along there to try to minimize any risk of discharge. It does, though, this method does typically limit itself to sites with fairly high transmissivity. And then that last one is a barrier, and it's a barrier where you basically have a linear transect. It's a barrier to contamination, not to groundwater flow. You're assuming your groundwater is going to flow through there and get treated. Another thing to consider is the behavior and persistence of your amendment itself. So some amendments might be more highly persistent, something like that emulsified emulsified vegetable oil, where you're going to have, it's going to stay in the subsurface for a while in comparison to, say, a lactate, which is going to get consumed fairly quickly. So that's the high persistence versus low persistence. And then in some sites, you're going to have low groundwater velocity, so you're not going to get a lot of spread of amendment with natural groundwater flow versus the other example there where you've got a higher groundwater velocity and you're going to get a further distribution under the same time frame. So to close out on this section, remedial design is iterative. You need to constantly evaluate the data you have. Refine the design following selection of amendment delivery strategy could involve things like bench tests, pilot tests, and the results of each one of these tests needs to feedback refinements into the subsequent test or the next version of your design. An iterative approach and constant evaluation of your new data will provide a strong design and a more successful remedial effort. And with that, I'm going to pass it to Elizabeth Reich, who's going to talk about the implementation and monitoring.
Super. Thank you very much, Suzanne. So, section four of this document covers how do you analyze for your data? What type of analytical parameters do you want to run based on what type of remedy you have selected? And it talks a lot about the different types of wells they are. And so this is just a graphic here that shows you that you have certain wells that you install, obviously, for your in-situ treatment. Those would be your injection wells. And that's typically done within your target treatment area or your target treatment zone, the TTZ, as we call it. You also have downgradient wells. You may have a point of compliance well, depending on what your regulatory program. Receptors such as streams or a residential area or simply a property boundary. You might have sentinel wells, so you can monitor the not only where the plume is going, but where your injectates are going as well, depending on what you're injecting. So refer to that on a little more detail on that. Keep in mind there are different types of monitoring. Typically, we will do, like a remedial investigation, and that is one type of monitoring. You're trying to delineate the source. And then, as Rich described, we're doing the remedial design characterization. What are those things that we need to know about the plume and where we need to implement our remedy and the characteristics within that area when it comes to geochemistry? And then you also have your compliance monitoring. Those are the things the regulators might require, your contaminants of concern, your COCs, as well as secondary contaminants that may come from your remedy itself. For instance, arsenic is often something that we are concerned about when doing reductive dechlorination, some other metals in use of oxidants. And those parameters will be required by various state regulatory agencies and are also very valuable in knowing what's going on with your plume and your remedy, I should say. There's also process monitoring that is done on a different frequency than, say, your compliance monitoring. I would say that process monitoring varies widely depending on what your remedy is. If you're doing an ISCO, some sort of chemical oxidant or chemical reductant, those reactions happen very quickly, and therefore you need to monitor it very quickly. Things, the biological processes occur much more slowly, and there may not be a need to do that more frequently than, say, quarterly or, some parameters even annually would be sufficient. One thing I will say is that field parameters are very inexpensive and have tremendous value. Whether you are measuring something as simple as temperature when you're doing oxidation remedies in adjacent wells, water level is going up and when you do an injection and monitoring that in your nearby wells. The pH, DO, ORP, I can't stress how important those are in a biological remedy because the biological organisms, are sensitive to pH. Just imagine your system being set up like you're setting up a fish tank. You go and put the water in your tank, you put chemicals in your tank, you monitor your tank, and you make sure the pH is there, ammonia is there, whatever, all your parameters are correct before you go to the, buy that expensive new fish to put your fish tank in. Your aquifer is kind of the same way. You would like for it to be in the best position it could be with that biochemistry before you start your other parts of your remedy, including bioaugmentation. I'm gonna need a hand here on advancing the screen. Okay, so what we have here is, this is just an example of two of the tables coming out of section four. The one on the left are some of the parameters that you can run from for if you're doing an anaerobic biostimulation with or without bioaugmentation. And the one on the right is for chemical oxidation. And you'll see this was supposed to, zoom in and zoom out, but we'll just talk to it. So what we are seeing here, a couple of things that I wanted to point out. The parameters may be your ultimate end products like methane, ethane. It'll tell you what are the interpretation guidelines and some recommendations depending on what you might see. One of the things I see a lot when I do a peer review of something is what is the ORP? And sulfate reduction occurs at negative 120 millivolts. Methanogenesis occurs at, I would say, negative 180 would be, the bare minimum, but you're really looking for negative 200 to negative 400 millivolts. And if you're not seeing that, you're probably not in methanogenesis. Some of the older EPA guidelines say, oh, it's anaerobic if your DO is less than 0.5 and your ORP is negative. That's really, really vague. Your ORP is negative. It needs to be really, really negative on the ORP for reductive dechlorination to be occurring. And now as we look at the chemical oxidation, and again, don't expect you to be able to read this, but I do expect to pique your interest for you to go to these tables. Some of the ultimate end products for chemical oxidation may be, like carbon dioxide, chloride. Keep in mind that these end products may dissipate very, very quickly. And so the fact that you don't see them doesn't mean it didn't occur. It could just be that quickly, and you're not going to see them. So don't over rely on that. If you could advance for me. Okay, all right, here we go. One of the points of section four is to understand, can you optimize your remedy? How do you identify if it's underperforming, and which one of those aspects is underperforming? We talked about the various different steps there, whether or not it's dose, delivery, or amendment. And so we're going to go through that here in a case study to see if you can identify, what was going on in this particular case study. Which one of those design criteria it might be? Can it be optimized? And, should we consider a supplemental remedy? Can you go back up one for me? I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm having technical difficulties here. Okay. So on this particular case study, a little bit of background. This is in the state of South Carolina, so it's Piedmont geology, pretty heterogeneous. There's a saprolite layer, varying thicknesses you'll see across section here in just a minute. There's also a transition zone as it goes into the granite bedrock. The total site's about 380 acres, of which the plume extends 12 acres of that. So a fairly sizable plume. The site that was up for sale, and the only developer that was interested in it happened to want to build a residential development, which of course changed our end goal from, an industrial setting to a residential setting. So that meant we needed to do something about this chlorinated solvent plume pretty quickly. And it currently had a pump and treat system, which was largely ineffective. If anything, it accelerated the migration of the plume down gradient, because they put the wells right there on the right up against the neighborhood and pump there and attempt to get hydraulic control before it hit the neighborhood. But really all they did was speed up the gradient as well as drag it down into the bedrock, because of course you can't pump a lot of water from the saprolite. And so they put the wells in the bedrock to be able to pump more water. So sometimes those pump and treat systems created a worse problem than they had before. But we were looking at ways to optimize the remediation there. Okay, so our choice there was anaerobic in situ bioremediation because the contaminants were primarily carbon tetrachloride and TCE. And of course, carbon tet can't be remediated through most ISCO processes. So bioremediation was the way we went. One of the things that we did, we evaluated the monitoring data monthly. That is the PHDO-ORP. Those are the numbers that change the quickest and give you the most data for the least amount of money. So we went out monthly and did those. Another aspect of trying to get this project done within 3 years was to know when to anticipate those changes. And if they're not acting, if we don't get the changes we expect, is to go in and act on that and implement your plan B and constantly be improving and optimizing. We did end up incorporating hydraulic fracturing in this one to improve the distribution. And we relied on the natural downward vertical gradients that were occurring at the site, and as well as monitored natural attenuation to address the bedrock. We did have a contingency plan for the bedrock, and luckily we did not have to address it. But one thing I would also stress in this class is to write a decision document and a plan that anticipates these things so that if you need to implement them, you can act quickly and you don't necessarily have to rewrite your work plan or, you know, make an amendment to your ROD or any of those types of things. So plan on flexibility, have that plan and hope you don't need to implement it, but know that it's there. So as Suzanne was talking about, there are multiple ways to do this. A lot of these projects are done in transects. Here we have a relatively slow groundwater velocity. And so we did, the shotgun approach, and we installed fixed injection wells on 25-foot centers. There were 134 injection wells within a 4.1-acre target treatment zone. That'll be the core of the plume, which you'll see in plan view here shortly. You see it here in cross-section on the lower right-hand corner. One of the interesting things when we did this, I like to collect as much data as possible when we are installing a system like this full scale, because it tells you some interesting information. And what we see here is there's a bedrock trough. And we actually, after we installed and developed each one of these wells, about 10% of them, we went out and collected a sample from just to see if we could refine that plume a little bit. And what we found was that on the edges where the thickness of the aquifer was less thick, what we see is that the concentrations are lower, and down here in the trough the concentrations were much higher. Not unusual for a chlorinated solvent plume to have that kind of setup, but we did want to make sure that we got wells on the fringe to make sure that we didn't have any areas that didn't meet our cleanup goals and prevented us from closing the site. So wells were already in. We made sure that we had some clean ones on the ends and to make sure that we would capture every bit of the plume. This was an automated injection system. And we were actually running molasses through this. And we started out with a 10% molasses solution on a continuous injection cycle. And so the automated system would inject in well one, and it would get to well 134, and then it would start back over again. It took it 30 hours to inject in that that format. And go to the next slide. And so here's the automated injection system up here. We had, you know, molasses in a tank, and we have this header pipe that went down. This represents the deepest part of the bedrock trough right here. And that way we could, it was an above ground installation. And so we could easily say, okay, this one's closest. These are the deeper wells here on either side. It just lended itself to a quick visual to help us plan what we were doing. So this is about 350 feet long here, this header right here. And then each of these wells were piped individually and tied up into a backup to the system. So we had complete control over each well individually. Yeah, we ran that system in that configuration for 6 months. And what we saw was pretty much textbook in the source area. So MCL started, this is total MCL's carbon tap plus TCE, and the source area wells was around 2.5 milligrams per liter. We see that go down. We see the daughter products. Excuse me, this is not total. This is just carbon tet here in the blue. It doesn't count the TCE because I wanted to really look at the chloroform and the methylene chloride in those particular daughter products here. So what we see is that once the carbon tet goes down, we see the chloroform go up. We also see the methane and the methylene chloride come up and then come back down again. This is absolute textbook in what you would expect to see. Unfortunately, though, we did not see that everywhere. If you take a look at it in plan view, here's the source area up here, and this is the part that cleaned up. These were the highest concentrations, and in 6 months, we cleaned them up. Down here on the lower end of the plume, it didn't clean it up as quickly as, well, it didn't clean up much at all. It's just a nominal reduction in concentration of carbon tet and TCE. So the pH dropped slightly after 12 months. That is not unusual in anaerobic reductive dechlorination because of all of the acids that are developed through that process. So not unusual, but you do need to be very, very careful about your pH because once it, if it drops too much, the bugs will die. It's again, going back to your fish tank analogy, you have to have that pH in that ideal zone. And so we had a plan to address that. We had a couple of different things we could do for pH that we did, but we did see increased methane concentrations. We saw ideal redox conditions, and by redox conditions, I'm back to the DO ORP. We had those in the source area, but it wasn't uniform across the plume. The distal end of the plume, again, it exhibited very little change. So you would think it would be easier to address low concentrations than it would be the high concentrations. So we asked ourselves, what's going on here? So here's the redox methanogenic. Again, ORP negative 180, negative 200, and even lower are in this range. In the middle, we are getting sulfate reducing DO ORP readings that are indicative of sulfate and iron reducing. And down here, we're still getting aerobic. So given this data that we just presented, do you think we have a delivery dose or amendment problem, or perhaps a little bit of each? Devin, I'll let you. Thank you. Okay, what do we have? All of the above. Yep, and that's the conclusion we had as well. There was just a little bit of all of the above. So no one's truly wrong, and there's some things that are more wrong than others. A couple of things. The degradation of byproducts, we didn't see those in this lower end of the plume. So we know the amendment works because it worked great in the source area. So is there a way to improve the amendment and optimize it? Maybe, but the general answer on that is that the amendment can work in this situation. We need to find out why it didn't work. The ROIs in the down gradient wells, is what we surmised the problem was lower. When we're injecting up here in these wells closer to the source area, there's actually some pressure behind them. But since these wells are 150 to 350 feet away from the source area, We're now gravity feeding the injectate into these wells where we're injecting them under pressure to those up close. So that changes our ROI a little bit. So that's an interesting problem and one that we can come up with a solution for. So we looked at the design wheel again. The amendment, the only issue we had with that was a little pH drop. The easiest way to fix that is to lower the carbon load so you generate fewer acids in the process. And so we lowered that carbon load from 10% to 5%. We were prepared to add some other, buffers and such to it, but actually our alkalinity was still pretty good. So we felt like that it wasn't going to drop too far. I read up on alkalinity in this document because I do think it is important to watch and know what your alkalinity is, because if you've got around 100 on your alkalinity, you've got a more stable environment and you're less likely to have rapid pH swings or changes. And then things like carbon sodium carbonate raise the alkalinity, whereas sodium bicarbonate doesn't address the alkalinity, it only addresses the pH. So there's some pluses and minuses. There's some trade-offs with using those two products. If you have to use something to control your pH, the document actually spells this out. So definitely, go back to the document and take a look at what it says there. So the dose, we want to increase that radius of influence. You can do that by increasing, the volume that you inject. And since we decreased the carbon load from 10% to 5%, we were able to easily double that. And we actually increased the volume from 10 gallons per foot of well screen to 25 gallons per foot of well screen. Delivery, we didn't really do a whole lot with the delivery at the moment. We ended up, adding a clean water flush to make sure that it got all the amendments out into the aquifer and not just resting in the line where it can ferment. So that was a delivery issue we solved. So we operated for 12 months more. So we're now 18 months into it. And what we're seeing is this right here is all clean and looking good. And we still have this one little recalcitrant area right here. We know it's one of the deeper parts of it because of where this line is. You can just see visually, okay, these are going to be our deeper wells along the trough. So what's going on here? So we fixed the, adjusted the pH. So our amendment looks pretty good now. We've changed our dose. We've increased it by 2.5 times to get a larger ROI. The delivery, we haven't done a whole lot with the delivery. So what would you think our next step is, and why are we having that little stubborn problem there? On the southeast corner. So, what say you? Have any poll answers? Delivery. Yep. So, like I said, I think we've solved the dose and the amendment for the large part, and our biggest problem remaining is truly a delivery problem. And we know this because we've been able to achieve so far our redox parameters we wanted to see elsewhere. So we know the amendment's working. We know the dose is better. Maybe we could improve the dose a little bit. But going back to the RDC and the design wheel and reviewing the boring logs, what is different about the wells in the southeast corner of the plume that we don't see elsewhere? And one of the things that we noticed were there were just a different variation in the silt and clay lenses that are in this area. And so what happens is that, of course, these contaminants can absorb onto clays and silts and get hung up there. And what happens then is that they are just constantly desorbing through back diffusion, and it just acts as a low-level source of mass. That prevents you from closing your site. And we've all had those sites that are just stubbornly at 10 parts per billion and you can't close them. And this is why it's the back diffusion from absorbed mass, not necessarily an apple or anything, you know, scary, but just particles that are sorbed onto that clay that are coming out. So how do we get at a clay layer? And Suzanne shared the EK when you've got really solid clays, and you know that's a great method. Another thing that helps is hydraulic fracturing. So we went out and did a pilot test of hydraulic fracturing. So what we know is that the reagent's going to take the path of least resistant, and it's getting hung up in these clays. So can we make that more permeable in the clays? So we're going to do that through a pilot test. So back to our design wheel, don't feel like you can't go back and try another pilot test. You may have your full scale implemented and you're very well on your way. But part of the optimization is, trying to figure out, hey, what will work and what's going to improve this so I can get it closed. So we jump back up here to this pilot stage, and then we'll continue back on through the full scale again. So here's just a couple slides about the pilot test. So we started with a direct push tooling. We pushed it into the ground, and then we used started a fracture with jetting water, and then we injected a sand proppant that was held in place with the food grade guar, which of course biodegrades and continues to act as a food source. It's very compatible with the ejectates for this particular bioremediation site, so it actually that helps us too. And we ejected that fracture here, and we also installed a series of piezometers, and we put data loggers in the piezometers so that when we injected into it, we could see what was going on. And so we inject just water in this case, and then what we see is no reaction in the logger down here at the deepest depth, a little bit of reaction here, but really good. What we came to determine here was that the influence was observed 3 to 4 feet above and below this particular fracture. So now we have inject, when we inject, we know that we can go not just radially from our injection well, but we can also go up and down from the fracture that we've installed. So we implemented a full scale fractures. There were actually 7 different intervals. I'm sorry, five different intervals at like 7 feet apart. And so we kept it off of the transition zone. This transition zone is very permeable, so we wanted to make sure that when we installed our injection well, we did not tee into this transition zone and then lose all of our fluid to this most permeable zone. So we had these five fractures on the edges. We might have only had three fractures, but we were able to install these. We injected into it again. We added a few more piezometers at these piezometers here are at like 20 feet out. These are 40 feet out. And we injected into that. And this is what it looks like in plan view. We have these, the injection wells themselves that intercept those fractures. And then we hook those up to the automated system. And we ran that for for several months. It took us 9 months to complete that hydraulic fracture pilot study and install the 11 sets of fractures. During that same time, we were monitoring what was going on in the source area, doing our rebound monitoring, making sure that all of that was good. And what we ended up seeing was that the conclusions we had from all of this was the ROI of each fracture set was about 45 feet. We injected once a month in this configuration. After 2 injection events, we saw the TOC concentrations hit the target, which was something else that I hadn't mentioned, but the total organic carbon, you need to set that at a particular level. Your bugs need a certain amount of carbon to, get them going. You can also get too much carbon, and if you do that, you're tend to generate more methane than you need to. And in some situations, that might be of a big concern. And in this particular site, there was no houses built there yet at that time, and it didn't really matter. So we had a little bit of leeway if we overshot our TOC and overshot our methane. But you do need to be mindful of that in most situations. We saw evidence of reductive chlorination in 6 months, meaning we saw all of our daughter products, you know, the carbon tet turned to chloroform and on through. The TCE went to cis, and then to final chloride, and then was completely dechlorinated. And after 9 months, we were able to transition to MNA. And after running the system we're almost at year three now, what we see is up here in the source area, we are returning to aerobic concentrations up here as the clean water front is moving through. This part where we're no longer injecting is becoming aerobic again. We were finally able to get the methanogenic conditions down here, and that's why we were able to see the reduction in COCs. So it's returning to normal. No one to stop. You know, and that sounds obvious, but it isn't always obvious. When you start costing out the cost of M&A, you may think, oh, great, I can turn the system down. I'm almost there. Keep in mind a couple of things. Number one, M&A costs money. If you don't want to be doing M&A for 10 years. If you could just operate the system for another 6 months and get rid of 10 years of M&A, you have probably saved money. Another thing to consider is this is biosystems. Once you drop below like 50 micrograms per liter of your contaminants, you don't have the right food source and the energy source that certain bacteria are looking for, and they die off. They don't have what they want, and things start slowing down naturally. So it's better just to keep going, and then trying to rely on M&A if you're looking at you know, your degradation curves, and you can say, oh, okay, 6 more months and I should be done. I would advise you to go ahead and do it instead of choosing M&A. Because there is a point of diminishing returns. And at that point, you should look at M&A. But it's all going to be dependent on your regulatory framework and your final site use. This one, again, being residential, we either needed to build vapor barriers or we needed to get it cleaned up to residential standards. In this particular case, I had a client here that was very risk averse, and they had been involved in a number of projects or sites that had emerging contaminants. And for that concern, they insisted upon putting in the vapor barriers. So we had those engineering controls in place. Even though we didn't necessarily need them for this particular remedy, it's just a little bit of peace of mind for our client that they're in there and they're not going to get sued. So not every client's like that. We were blessed with this. This one was very easy to work with. So we also had to go back and redo some of the deed restrictions that were on the property because they already restricted it to industrial only. And so we had to do a little bit of paperwork on that side, but we were able to meet all the requirements for the regulatory agency and were able to get this one, the apartments built with no delays. So just a quick recap of the 12 acre plume that we started with, we treated the target treatment zone was 4.1 acres and we achieved MCLs or got pretty close to it. There were a couple of wells that were like 6 or 8 micrograms per liter against an MCL of 5. So natural attenuation occurred in the remaining 8 acres that were down gradient and in the bedrock. So cutting the head off the snake and the rest of it just attenuated. So we were lucky there. A couple of other things to consider: what's the future use for the property? You know, some sites, you know, have different end games. You know, this says that we transitioned to M&A when it was below 5 times the MCL. It was much closer than that to the MCL in this particular case. So different states allow different M&A to go at different concentrations. Some states have risk-based closure, all things to look at. So including the original pump and treat remedy, there were four different cycles of optimization before we reached M&A and were actually able to redevelop the site. Monthly evaluation was critical. Those PHDO-ORP and total organic carbon, if you are doing a bioremediation site, I can't stress enough how valuable that information is. When your folks get in out of the field, you need to look at that data. Don't wait for your annual report and then go, oh, wow, my pH is 4.5 and my DO is still 1.3 and my ORPs are only negative 50 or something like that. And having done nothing about it for 12 months, your client will not be happy with you in that case. So definitely use that field data. You can also, we had a DO multimeter probe that we just stuck down in the well and did it in situ. It didn't take very long. Sent some guys out to the site for a couple of hours, get a lot of data, and just have them call you. And then you can go in, and since ours was automated, I could actually have them adjust the system while they were there. I also can't encourage you enough to have a contingency plan up front and make sure that all of that information is in your work plan and in your decision documents, so that if you want to do something like hydraulic fracturing, you don't have to go back and get approval for that. You just implement it. So there are five general strategies that the document's broken up into: anaerobic biostimulation, which is what the case study was about. But if you read the document, there is also a lot of information about aerobic biostimulation, ISCO, ISCR, surfactant, and co-flushing. I've recently worked on a surfactant project. I wish I'd known what I know now when we were working on this document. There are so many things that I would add to improve the document on surfactant and co-flushing that I wish I'd known when we wrote it. But anyway, refer to the document. It's full of useful tables, fact sheets. It will tell you know, what are those parameters that will give you the most information, depending on which one of those five general categories of injectates you're using, how to interpret that data, what's important, what's not important. I think one of the things that I look at, how many times have I seen a site where they're collecting data that's clearly for a anaerobic bioremediation site, but it's an ISCO project. I'm like, okay, so what are we going to do with this particular data? I don't see that shows any value, but somebody brought it into a work plan and now we have to keep collecting it, and because the state won't let us drop it. So, keep that in mind. What don't collect data you don't need. Don't collect data for, a BTEC site like you would collect data for a TCE site. That sounds basic to some of you, but I see it all the time. Sample frequency. There's some guidelines in the document that will make some recommendations. Every site is different. Every geology is different. You have to pull everything together, yourself to make sure you're doing what's appropriate for your site. But there's some general guidelines in the document about, how often you should collect certain data. But just keep in mind that every site is specific and these remedies are very, very different. Contingency planning, definitely have one. Nothing goes as exactly as planned. That's just kind of a rule. So, with that in mind, I will turn you back over for the regulatory and stakeholder considerations.
All right. Thank you, Elizabeth. This is Chris again. We as regulators need this document too, so we don't fall into the old ways of linear thinking. And that's another benefit of presenting an optimization document via the web and ITRC to expose the states to this iterative and interactive way of thinking and design. As you can see from this graphic, EPA recognizes that need for an adaptive management style for their Superfund projects. This figure, which was modified from that memo, clearly shows an iterative process similar to the key graphic of this document and everything you just heard from Suzanne and Elizabeth. Next slide, please. Even though remedial activities may occur in situ, i.e. underground or on private property, the activities are noticed by people living and working in the surrounding communities. They want to know how the activity may affect their lives. Honest and upfront communication can go a long way to alleviate fear of the unknown. It may reveal potential consequences we were not previously thought of. It's important to develop a media communications plan, identifying a single point of contact. Anticipate questions in advance and develop a fact sheet and list of FAQs, frequently asked questions. All answers should be clear and concise. Next slide. So, this is our last slide. We want you to use this document. Use it like your toolbox. Use the table in Appendix B to place you in the right position for this document. Make sure your CSM is complete by referring to Table 2-2. And dive into the fact sheets. Use the hot links. As I stated in my introduction, use this document for making predictable and optimized outcomes for in-situ remedies using sound science and engineering. As soon as we end this webinar, go to the guidance document on the web and upload Appendix F checklist to begin using everything you've learned here for your site. Okay, it's now time for our last Q&A session. Devin?
All righty. Thank you very much, Chris. With that, I am going to look directly to our Q&A pod for questions for our trainers. Our first question, how do you know the impact is not being flushed or forced deeper into the site?
Now, hi, Devin. This is Rich DeRosa with GZA. I think that's an excellent question and one that, you know, all practitioners should be asking before going out and conducting an in-situ process. I guess I'll give two examples. One would be through the use of high-resolution site characterization, understanding where your plume is defined. And we had a site where we thought we really knew what was going on, and we were injecting above a clay unit for about 15 feet with concentrations at, you know, 6 to 10 parts per million of TCE. We ran some high-resolution site characterization, went through the clay unit, and down 5 additional feet where we had a boundary condition below regulatory standards. In between that boundary condition and that upper clay unit was another 9 ppm TCE concentration where the data itself wouldn't support. However, looking at it, we found that there was a vertical upward flow from the lower well up to the clay unit, and therefore we would have missed the TCE. So the example there really goes to this question here, is that we knew that we had a lower boundary unit, so you needed to find the vertical delineation of your plume. So when you're injecting, you have two choices. You can inject from top down or bottom up. My preference is usually bottom up, so that you're injecting material into your clean zone and then working your way up through your contaminant zone. So if you do have anything that is pushed down, it's going to go into your amendment. But also, if you have a vertical well below the amendments that you're injecting, you'll be able to determine whether or not your amendment process is actually going in deeper. And then also, as the example earlier was talking about doing an injection to figure out your radius of influence. Again, that way there, you'll also know, is your amendment going to be vertically going downward? Do you have an upward flow, which could work to your advantage? Any of those things are going to be, you know, your tools that you need to do up front. So going back to the remedial design characterization, you need all of those points so that you can demonstrate to the regulators that you have successfully remediated the plume and just not moved the plume someplace. So again, wells that are outside the limits of the plume to make sure that it hasn't gone beyond the limits. And again, I also like injecting from the clean zone into the hot zone on the horizontal. and injecting from a clean zone at the bottom up through the plume and then up into a clean zone above it. So think about it as a balloon. Your balloon in the middle is the contamination. You want to address it from the outside in. And I hope that helps put that in perspective.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Rich. Next question, how should injection pressures be determined?
Again, I could start with that. Again, your injection studies ahead of time, your pilot test, you'll get some information. I always use pressure gauges so I can understand what's going in to the formation, as well as controlling my pressure. I'm looking at flow. So you want to make sure that flow is going into the formation and pressures are just not going up. And that also gets back into your design of things, such as injection wells are differently constructed than monitoring wells because you want to push the amendment into the formation. So again, you might choose a larger screen interval and a larger sand pack so that you can reduce those pressures in the formation. But all of this gets back into your preliminary design information. I'm sure maybe one of the other trainers may have something in terms of their experiences.
Yeah, so if you, the higher the injection pressure, you can inadvertently hydrofract something. When you do use hydraulic fracturing or pneumatic fracturing, it should be intentional. And you should know that you're doing it, why you're doing it, and not just injecting at a really high pressure and creating a fracture that is not controlled and not intentional. So it's a good question. And the other thing I would say about injection pressure is be mindful of your equipment and the health and safety hazards that are associated with injecting under high pressure and not having the proper to do so. I've seen people come out and inject under pressure and they've got a firm coat holding everything together. And it's just like, someone's going to get hurt here. A lot of things to be mindful about pressures. And, a pilot test is a good way to get an idea on what that pressure should be.
And I think lastly, as you're looking at your pressures, look at adjacent monitoring wells. On this site that we had with the clays, it was in a delta unit, so we did have fine grain materials going into a coarser grain material in the deltaic sequence. And we were injecting 5 feet away from a monitoring well, and our ROI predicted was 15 feet. As we were injecting, we saw no product in that monitoring well, never, even at 5 feet away. So there was something with the geology. So you just don't want to up your pressures because you're thinking the pressure increase is going to make it go someplace. It doesn't really work that way. We ended up having to retool that and do a hydraulic push-pull circulation for groundwater to get it through those finer grain materials. So just because you think you can add more flow and add increased pressures, as Elizabeth indicated, you may think you're going to frack something in the formation, but those formations have been there for millennium or decades. So you're not going to do things. So that's the reason why we always run pilot tests.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So that is it for our questions for today's session. I would just like to take a moment up with some logistics for everybody, and then I'll wish you on your way. So we do have feedback forms that are available for if you would like a certificate of completion. They are available through that. If you registered and paid for continuing education unit, we do ask that you complete the feedback form as a final step on your participation for today's webinar. Once you do that, the CEU certificate will be emailed to you within usually about a business week. If you have any further questions or would like any clarification on any questions or answers provided, we encourage you to email us at training@itrcweb.org. You're also welcome to get in touch with our trainers directly. Their information is listed on the Fluent training page that brought you here today. So with that, I would just like to say thank you to all of our attendees that joined us, and a very big thank you to our trainers for being here today and delivering this wonderful training. This wraps up our 2023 training, and we have open registration for some new classes in 2024, and I encourage you to check those out and register. And with that, I'd just like to wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day and holiday season, and thank you for joining us.